From NPR News, this is special coverage. The Supreme Court hears challenges to the health care overhaul that Congress passed and President Obama signed into law just over 2 years ago. I'm Jennifer Ludden. The Supreme Court today began 6 hours of historic hearings on the 2010 health care overhaul. The question, whether President Obama's signature achievement is constitutional. The court hasn't devoted this much time to a case in nearly half a century since 1966, and an institution that usually steers clear of politics finds itself deciding a highly partisan issue in an especially polarizing election year, its decision expected by late June. In a nod to the intense interest in the case, the court took the unusual step of releasing audio tape of its arguments shortly after they took place, and we'll be hearing excerpts in a moment. First, the scene outside. People from across the country lined up for days for the chance to watch the proceedings in person. Kathy McClure of Atlanta camped out since Friday.
It's poured rain. It's been freezing cold. This morning at 4, we got hit with a sprinkler, so all of our stuff got doused and wet again. You know, I've met all kinds of interesting people. We're sleeping here in front of between the Capitol and the Supreme Court. You really just can't beat it for high-quality life experience.
Many others simply wanted to make their voices heard.
As a pediatrician, no, I think everyone that I've spoken to and discussed this with has supported the law completely.
We love the Constitution. We love the Constitution.
We believe this thing is going to be overturned in its entirety.
A media circus also descended on the court, and in that crowd was NPR's Ari Shapiro, who joins us now in Studio 3A. Hi, Ari.
Hi, Jennifer.
So, what was the atmosphere like there?
Well, as you heard, there was a lot of marching and shouting and chanting, but, you know, we were all just talking before this special started about how surprised we were at really how sort of mild-mannered the scene was. This court has sometimes been the scene of really over-the-top massive protests. Today, you had supporters of the law marching in a circle at some point with a four-piece brass band with people with bullhorns shouting slogans and singing songs, as you heard. They were clearly organized. They had printed signs that were all identical. Many of them wore T-shirts showing that they were from unions, from the National Organization of Women, from groups of healthcare providers. And then in another corner, there were the opponents of the healthcare law who were actually vastly outnumbered by the law's supporters. These people looked a little more kind of grassroots, a little more homemade. Their signs were all lettered from scratch, and some of them wore Tea Party Patriot shirts. They had American flags. One had a Don't Tread on Me flag. There was a big Tea Party presence over the weekend, but today, a very small group there outside of the court.
Sounds highly organized and maybe a bit festive.
Yeah, and there was a lot of shouting, but really not a lot of shouting at each other. It never really felt like it got out of control.
So to drive home just how political this case is, I take it the GOP primary race actually came to the Supreme Court today.
Yeah, we were sitting on the steps of the Supreme Court when an alert came out from the campaign of Rick Santorum saying Santorum will be campaigning on the steps of the Supreme Court at 12:20 p.m. today. And sure enough, on schedule, his black SUV pulled up, the Secret Service showed up, people with microphones, and he stepped in front of these banners that said no to Obama, Romney care. And he stepped up and made the case that not only is the federal health care law, in his view, unconstitutional, but he says it's indistinguishable from the Romney law in Massachusetts. Let's listen to part of what he said.
If we run this campaign, which I will, on Obamacare, and we make this the central issue in the campaign, and we're successful, there's no doubt that Obamacare will be repealed in one form or another. And that's not going to be the case with Governor Romney, because he can't make it the argument. Because if he makes it the argument, the Obama machine will turn it right back on him, and therefore there won't be the mandate. He may say he wants to repeal Obamacare, but he won't have the mandate through the course of this campaign to be able to win the argument, not just here in Congress, but across the country. I'll be making that argument throughout the course of our campaign. If we're successful, it'll be very clear where the American public is.
Although I have to say, again, you expect that the GOP presidential nominating contest descends on the biggest Supreme Court case in a decade or decades, that it would be this kind of apocalyptic Clash of the Titans thing. You know, he showed up, he talked for about 5 minutes, he left, and it was over.
All right, so very civil there. Well,
you know, that is really in such contrast to some other big cases we've seen argued. I mean, Julie and I both have covered big abortion cases where protesters were throwing fake fetuses around, and there was a lot of screaming and yelling, and it was really awful. Today was sort of nice democracy. I don't know whether tomorrow will be that way, but today was nice democracy.
All right, we have NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, health policy correspondent Julie Rovner, and also attorney Tom Goldstein, co-founder of SCOTUS blog, here to help us move inside the courtroom now. And Nina, set up what the argument today focused on.
Really arcane, dense, dense stuff. I kept looking at my colleagues to see if they understood something I didn't. The answer is no.
Okay, but we're so happy you were there instead of us to explain it.
So the basic notion of tax law that dates back to a law from 1867 is you pay first, litigate later. And that's because otherwise, every time somebody didn't like a provision of the tax code, they could tie it up in court. So the idea is you have to pay the tax, then you object to it. If you win in court later, you get your money back, with interest even possibly, but you get your money back. Well, this is the opposite of that. In this case, in order for this case to go forward, we have to decide that the issues when nobody's paid any tax or any tax penalty, none of that kicks in until the mandate kicks in 2014. And the first time anybody will pay a tax penalty is 2015. If you don't have health insurance, you have to pay a penalty, which is assessed under your income taxes, and the money goes to the IRS. But it sure isn't in the Treasury now. So the question is, can the case go forward before anybody's injured, before that happens?
And there's quite an oddity here, because neither the government nor the challengers think this is a tax. And the court actually had to appoint an outside attorney to argue that it is, Robert Long. It sounds unusual.
So in this case, both the challengers and the government agree the case should be decided now for differing reasons. So the court said, look, we better get this, or at least somebody has to make the argument that it shouldn't be decided now. And they appointed Robert Long to do that.
Let's listen to a bit of his arguments.
Specifically on the argument that it is actually a tax, even setting aside the point that it should be assessed and collected in the same manner as a tax. The Anti-Injunction Act uses the term tax. It doesn't define it. Somewhat to my surprise, tax is not defined anywhere in the Internal Revenue Code. In about the time that Congress passed the Anti-Injunction Act, tax had a very broad definition. It's broad enough to include this exaction, which is codified in the Internal Revenue Code. It's part of the taxpayer's annual income tax return. The amount of the liability and whether you owe the liability is based in part on your income. It's assessed and collected by the IRS.
There's at least some doubt about it, Mr. Long, for the reasons that Justice Breyer said. And I thought that we had a principle that ousters of jurisdiction are narrowly construed, that unless it's clear, courts are not deprived of jurisdiction. And I find it hard to think that this is clear, whatever else it is. It's easy to think that it's not clear.
Well, I mean, the Anti-Injunction Act applies not only to every tax in the code, but as far as I can tell, to every tax penalty in the code.
Okay, and that was an exchange with Attorney Robert Long and Justice Antonin Scalia. Tom Goldstein, can you maybe interpret a bit what we heard there and tell us how the argument went over with the justices?
Sure. Well, all the lawyers did a great job today. The only thing that could describe how the appointed lawyer's argument went over is really the kind of phrase lead balloon. The justices were really interested in the argument, principally for the reason that they were kind of scrambling over each other to explain why it is that they could decide the big issue in the case, the constitutionality of the individual mandate. They either thought that the plaintiffs here were not challenging a tax because what they're challenging is the mandate, not a tax, or if they were challenging something that this arcane statute applied to, well, then the government could waive its objection and they could go ahead and decide it anyway.
Let's get a little flavor of that skepticism. Even Justice Stephen Breyer, who made a point of saying, you know, I'm leaning toward agreeing with you on this. However, he expressed some skepticism. Let's listen.
I accept pretty much. I'm probably leaning in your favor on jurisdiction. But where I see the problem is in the second part, because the second part says restraining the assessment or collection of any tax. Now, here, Congress has nowhere used the word tax. What it says is penalty. Moreover, this is not in the Internal Revenue Code, but for purposes of collection. And so why is this a tax? And I know you point to certain sentences that talk about taxes within the code.
Right.
This is not attached to a tax. It is attached to a health care requirement.
Right.
So why does it fall within that word?
Okay, so when a penalty by any other name, Julie Rovner, penalty, tax, what about this law can we look at to divine which it is?
Well, you know, for the healthcare reporters who've been following this, this has been one of the great big semantic games of this. You know, there are reasons that it looks like a tax. Obviously, you pay it to the IRS. That would be a pretty good one. On the other hand, you know, everybody knows the IRS can come and, you know, attach your house or your wages. In this case, they can't do that. So there are a lot of things that would make this look not like a tax. So this has got all kinds of interesting ramifications. You can go either way.
Weren't they? Then the question also come up, would you, if you did not pay it, be considered a lawbreaker?
Yes, but they can't send you to jail.
I think they said actually they would not send, the government would not consider you a lawbreaker, but the argument was made, why wouldn't you be? And I guess
it's unclear. You would be in violation, but there are no penalties. They can't do anything about it.
Okay. So we're still aren't quite sure at the end of this, Nina, briefly.
Welcome to my world, folks. How many angels can dance on a head of a pin?
Okay. A penalty or a tax. We're going to continue this and hear the arguments now made by the government and its challengers in just a moment. I'm Jennifer Ludden. You're listening to special coverage of the Supreme Court's healthcare arguments from NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage. The Supreme Court hears arguments in the historic challenge to the federal health care law. I'm Jennifer Ludden. The Supreme Court today considered whether it's too early to take up the case against the health care overhaul Congress passed in 2010 with the strong support of President Obama. At issue, whether the penalty assessed for those who don't have health insurance is a tax. The court actually appointed an outside lawyer to make that case. He cited an 1867 law, the Anti-Injunction Act, that says you can only challenge a tax after you've paid it, which in the case of the health care law would be in 2015. But many justices seemed skeptical of his arguments. In fact, neither the government nor the 26 states in the business group opposing the health care law argue that the penalty is a tax. Here to tell us about their positions, NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, attorney Tom Goldstein of SCOTUS Blog, and NPR correspondents Julie Rovner and Ari Shapiro. Now, Nina, the government early on in this effort actually did take the position this penalty was a tax and then changed its mind. Why?
I think because they thought they were going to lose. and they did it only momentarily at, I think, the district court level, and then they stopped doing it because it was getting just too arduous. So
there are enough ways to skin this cat. They still maintain that it's a tax for purposes of the power, the authority to levy a penalty. But that's really only a tertiary argument. That's not one of their main arguments.
All right.
But I also think that politically the Obama administration decided it was not in their best interest to kick this down to 2015. I guess we'll get to the politics in some detail later. But one reason to change position on whether it's a tax or not is to get the case decided and out of the way.
Right. It's not just get it decided and out of the way, but HHS, which administers the statute, needed an answer about whether it could move forward with putting the statute into place, and waiting till 2015 and then unwinding the whole thing would have been a disaster.
And Julie, you actually sat through all the sausage making in Congress. Was it ever called a tax in any draft?
No, and it was very specifically not called a tax because, if you'll recall, the Republicans decided they did not want to play this game. They wanted to have nothing to do with this law, so they needed basically every single Democrat in the Senate and virtually all the Democrats in the House. And to get those conservative Democrats, particularly in the House, they needed to not call it a tax. They were not going to vote for anything called a tax, so they very, very clearly did not call it a tax. And in fact, that's the reason why there's no enforcement, too, because I think it was in the Senate Finance Committee that the Republicans called their bluff and said, are you going to put people in jail for not paying this? And so there was actually an amendment, and the Democrats ended up voting for the amendment. That's why you can't put people in jail over this. It was basically an amendment that they approved in the Finance Committee that remained in the bill and is now law.
All right. Well, Solicitor General Donald Verrilli argued for the government. Let's listen to a bit of his argument. Justice Samuel Alito started an exchange with him that seemed to capture the difficulty and complexity of the government's position here.
General Verrilli, today you're arguing that the penalty is not a tax. Tomorrow you're going to be back and you'll be arguing that the penalty is a tax. Has the court ever held that something that is a tax for purposes of the taxing power under the Constitution is not a tax under the Anti-Injunction Act?
No, Justice Alito, but the court has held in the licensed tax cases that something can be a constitutional exercise of the taxing power, whether or not it is called a tax. And that's because the nature of the inquiry that we will conduct tomorrow is different from the nature of the inquiry that we will conduct today. Tomorrow, the question is whether Congress has the authority under the taxing power to enact it, and the form of words doesn't have a dispositive effect on that analysis. Today, we're construing statutory text where the precise choice of words does have a dispositive effect on the analysis.
Okay, Tom Goldstein, we're parsing words again here.
Okay, Tom!
What did you take from that?
Sure. Well, on some level, the government wants to have its cake and eat it too. Today, it wants the Affordable Care Act not to be a tax, because if it's a tax, then maybe you have to wait several years before you can have a lawsuit resolving its constitutionality. Tomorrow, it has a varsity argument for upholding the statute and a junior varsity argument. The varsity argument is that it is under Congress's interstate commerce power. We'll talk too much about that tomorrow. But its junior varsity argument is that Congress has a very broad power to pass taxes. So the government wants to be able to say tomorrow, in defending the constitutionality of the statute, that this thing falls within the congressional tax power. But today it can't say that. It can't say the T word.
Nina, did this fly?
No, I don't think really. I mean, these were cats playing with some little thing they were moving around. They're playing around the floor. The justices, it was pretty clear to everybody they're going to decide this case. They're going to move on to what are called the merits of the case. They're not going to get stopped by this. And they were just sort of pulling the wings off of the fly, to mix my metaphors, to torture counsel occasionally.
But if they were skeptical that it's not a tax, they didn't quite agree that... No, I'm sorry. They were skeptical... I'm confused. They were skeptical with the outside attorney they brought in, but they weren't really going along with the government's argument.
But this is really what they do. This is it's not really accurate to say it's a game, but they push everybody around pretty hard to find out where the weak points are in their argument. And this was an obvious weak point. I mean, it would have been you heard Donald Verrilli. He was very prepared for that question. He certainly knew he was going to get that question. He knew they were going to try to rip his wings off. So he was holding on to them pretty tight.
All right. Well, we can't resist. Verrilli himself seemed to get a little confused between the terms tax and penalty at one point in an exchange with Justice Elena Kagan. Let's listen.
The nature of the representation you made, that the only consequence is the penalty. Suppose a person does not purchase insurance, a person who is obligated to do so under the statute, doesn't do it, pays the penalty instead, and that person finds herself in a position where she's asked the question, have you ever violated any federal law? Would that person have violated a federal law?
No. Our position is that that person should give the answer no.
And that's because?
That if they don't pay the tax, they violated a federal law.
But as long as they've paid the penalty?
If they've paid the tax, then they're in compliance with the law.
Why do you keep saying tax?
If they pay the tax penalty, they're
Thank
in compliance
you.
With the law. Thank you, Justice Breyer.
A penalty.
Yes, right.
And he had the decency to blush.
All right. I guess even the top-notch lawyers get a little confused there. The consequences of the court's decision also came up today. Tom, a couple of justices, at least, right, Nina, mentioned that a friend of the court briefed by two former IRS commissioners who warned that if the court does not consider this penalty a tax, it will prompt a whole flood of cases. What did that mean?
Well, the justices seemingly would love to be able to say that this statute, the Anti-Injunction Act, doesn't bar them deciding a case about this other statute, the Health Care Reform Act. But they're always concerned about the implications of their decisions. What can of worms are they opening up? And so they wanted to know, if they said that this isn't a tax and therefore you can bring the suit today, what other suits could be brought today? And Justice Alito had the good example of, well, could lots and lots, maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people contest the penalty imposed on them for not getting health insurance? Could the federal courts be flooded? So they're always looking down the road at the implications of their decisions.
Okay. Let's also hear from Gregory Katsas. He was the lawyer representing the 26 states and some businesses who are challenging this health care law. He agrees with the government on this point, but he invoked the mandate, the health care mandate at one point, to have health insurance in one of his arguments, and he talked about the possible impact on the states. Let's listen to this exchange also with Justice Elena Kagan.
Finally, with respect to the states, even if we are wrong about everything I've said so far, the states clearly fall within the exception recognized in South Carolina against Reagan. They are injured by the mandate because the mandate forces 6 million new people onto their Medicaid rolls. But they are not directly subject to the mandate, nor could they violate the mandate and incur a penalty.
Could I just understand, Mr. Katsas, when the states say that they're injured, are they talking about the people who are eligible now but who are not enrolled, or are they also talking about people who will become newly eligible?
It's people who will enroll, people who wouldn't have enrolled had they been given a voluntary choice.
But who are eligible now?
That's the largest category. I think there could be future eligibles who would enroll because they're subject to a legal obligation but wouldn't have enrolled if given a voluntary choice. But I'm happy to focus on currently eligible people who haven't enrolled in Medicaid. That particular class is the one that gives rise to, simply in Florida alone, a pocketbook injury on the order of $500 to $600 million per year.
But that does seem odd to suggest that the state is being injured because people who could show up tomorrow with or without this law will show up in greater numbers. I mean, presumably the state wants to cover people whom it has declared eligible for this benefit.
Julie Rovner, that does seem like a bit of an odd position there. Tell us what was being argued.
Well, it depends what you consider an injury, but these are people, and this is something that the states are worried about. With this Medicaid expansion, the federal government is going to pay the vast majority of it, but one of the things the states are worried about is that people, as the attorney said, who are currently eligible for the program but not signed up will now sign up because they need to have health insurance. They're required to have health insurance, although I must point out that people who are very low income wouldn't have to pay the penalty, so technically they're exempt. But the state, there will still be this sort of moral suasion to sign up. So the states are worried if those people come forward, the federal government will not pay the vast majority. They will only pay the regular, what's called the Medicaid matching rate, which in a state like Florida I think would be 50-50, and that would be a lot of money for Florida. So, you know, Florida doesn't want to pay for those people to have Medicaid.
Even though they qualify today,
I suppose Florida considers that an injury.
Nina?
Justice Ginsburg sort of seemed
puzzled by this in a way. She said, well, why wouldn't people sign up for Medicaid if they're eligible? They must not know that it's available. Basically, she was saying, are you telling us that they just don't, you haven't advertised it well enough, therefore they don't know about it, and there are all these people out there who might avail themselves if they just knew they were eligible?
Well, maybe now there will be a flood.
there are, in fact, several million people who are eligible for Medicaid who are not enrolled for a variety of reasons, many of whom, as Nina said, do not know.
All right. Well, let's leave the tax argument for a moment and move on to look at the politics surrounding this case. It's kind of hard to ignore. Nina, do you think it's a factor for the justices?
You know, both yes and no. Justices are a product of their own ideology, their judicial ideology. And they were appointed because they have certain ideological views of how to interpret the law. So I don't think that there's any member of this court who's on one side or another because he thinks this will help the Democrats or this will help the Republicans. But are they coming to the view that they come to because this is the kind of person they are, the intellectual kind of person they are? Yes. And that's why they were appointed in some ways.
All right. This is a court, though, that prides itself on not being involved in politics.
They have fought so hard not to be perceived as political, and yet substantial majorities of Americans view the Supreme Court and lower courts' actions as influenced by Republican-Democrat politics. And so, as hard as the justices try, in speeches, in books, in everything that they do to send out this message that we are not influenced by party politics, for whatever reason, the message that reaches the American people is this is a political organization making political decisions. And that's something that's been a fight for at least the last decade since Bush v. Gore and probably well before that.
Well, and Tom Goldstein, I've seen analysis that, you know, Chief Justice John Roberts might be aware of this and loathe to have a partisan 5-4 decision. I mean, do you think this is something that goes into that?
Well, I should mention just at the beginning, now that we move beyond the Anti-Injunction Act, I did file on another part of this case a brief for the AARP. In terms of the chief's kind of interest and perspective on the case, he isn't talking to anybody, but, you know, there's a Roberts court. Before that, there was a Rehnquist court. There was a Berger court. There was a Warren court. And they all have kind of signal moments in them that go down in history through the centuries. And this is that moment for him and for this court. It's hard to imagine a case with broader stakes because it touches electoral politics, the presidency, the power of Congress. And so he has to be aware of it. And you see the awareness of it in scheduling 6 hours of oral argument over 3 days, which is highly unusual, the release of the audio in the same day, which is unusual for the court currently. And so it's fair to say that he's attentive to it.
And Nina, what about public opinion, which has shifted on this, but latest polls seem to suggest a lot of people don't like this law?
Public opinion shifts significantly depending on how you ask the question. So I must say the polls, obviously the country is closely divided on this, but because the shift is as much as 10 or 15 percentage points, depending on how the question is asked, I don't put a huge stake in that. But I did want to say something. The justices do not perceive themselves as partisans. They do perceive themselves as intellectual leaders, as it were. What makes this so difficult now is that the court is much more predictable and falls much more along party lines. And this court has done some extraordinarily new things. It hit, you know, when it in the campaign finance area, it basically abandoned nearly a century of court understandings. So it's gotten a lot of hits for being a conservative activist court as opposed to the Warren court, which was getting hit for being a liberal activist court. And that's partly what's in play here, I think. That's what they care about. They think they're honest and true to the Constitution, and they don't want to be perceived as partisans, and that's what's so difficult for them when they look at the way we write about them and the way people perceive them.
They really want to get rid of the legacy of Bush versus Gore. They want to tackle something huge and not have it come down ideologically. Remember, now, unlike in Bush versus Gore, the 5 most conservative justices are all Republican appointees. the four more liberal justices are all Democratic appointees. It would be a train wreck for, in the wake of that, for the court to, however it comes down, nonetheless come down on the basis of party, when the not the subtext, the real true text of this case is that it's in the middle of an election year and it's the Republicans against the Democrats, against the president.
But if they really feel that way, 5-4, the liberals appointed the Democratic appointed justices want to support this law and the Republican appointed ones don't want to, if they sincerely feel that way but they don't want this 5-4 split, what do they do?
They need one Republican. The Democratic appointees need one Republican to win.
And if they can't get him, they won't get him, and yeah, it'll be 5-4, and that's the way it is. Yeah. But every single one of those justices would prefer to avoid that outcome.
Julie Ruffin.
And there's something really important to say about public opinion on this, because when you look at these polls, they tend to be very closely divided, but when you divide it by party, Democrats are very strongly in favor of the law, Republicans very strongly against it. In fact, the only Democrats who aren't in favor of it are those who wish it had gone further. So even within sort of that very closely divided on the law. And then when you ask the questions, when you take the law apart, when you say, do you like this law, it looks like most people don't. But when you ask, do you like take out the individual pieces of the law, almost every individual piece of the law gets a majority, or in many cases, huge majority support, some even among Republicans, except the individual mandate.
All right. Very briefly, Ari Shapiro, the decision from these hearings is expected late June.
Middle of a presidential election, and so potentially huge political consequences, but not in the obvious way that you might think. Maybe the simplest thing to say is that most voters do not vote on the basis of Supreme Court appointments, and this may remind them that any president is likely to get at least one or maybe more lifetime appointees to the Supreme Court, which is one of the longest-lasting legacies of any president. But in terms of the substance of the decision, Republicans run on this platform of, I will repeal Obamacare. If Republicans get the House and Senate and the White House, then even if the Supreme Court does uphold this law, they can repeal it. So the Supreme Court upholding the law, perhaps a political win for Obama, but perhaps also a political win for the Republicans, who may be more motivated to get their guy into office.
All right. And we'll have more analysis coming right up. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and you're listening to special coverage of the Supreme Court's healthcare arguments from NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage. The Supreme Court hears arguments in the historic challenge to the federal health care law. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. We've been talking about the first day of historic Supreme Court hearings on President Obama's signature achievement, the 2010 health care overhaul. The court is considering whether the law is constitutional. Its decision, expected in late June, could decide not only the fate of the law, but may also impact the presidential election. For 2 years since the law was approved, supporters and opponents have waged a campaign in the court of public opinion, and public attitudes have shifted in that time. Julie Ravner is here to tell us, what are the latest polls showing about support for this health care law?
Well, the latest polls, and there was one out even just tonight, as I mentioned in the last segment, do indeed find that the public is pretty evenly divided. But again, Democrats much more supportive, Republicans much less supportive. Again, if you look at most of the elements of the law, things like allowing young adults to stay on their parents' health health plans requiring insurance companies to sell to people with pre-existing conditions. Those tend to be the very most popular provisions. They're supported by upwards of 80% of the public. Often you'll see 60 or 70% of Republicans. Really, the only thing that polls at less than 50% is that individual mandate. Interestingly, in 2011, the Kaiser Family Foundation asked people if they knew that most people, if you already have health insurance from your employer, and if you get to keep that health insurance, that would satisfy the mandate. When they told people that, opposition dropped to 35%.
So people are thinking they have to drop what they have for this law.
That's right. They think they have to drop their health insurance and go out and buy it, and that's because I think it's been misexplained, misperceived. People, the mandate's often described as, you know, the mandate is one that you have to, is a mandate to buy insurance, and it's not a mandate to buy insurance, it's a mandate to have insurance, starting in 2014.
I think, confusion I've heard around the exemption from that mandate, or at least from the penalty if you don't buy it. Everyone thinks they're going to be charged if they don't.
That's right. There's a brand new study out also just tonight from the Urban Institute, and it found that only about 7% of the population will actually be impacted by the mandate at all. And that's because, as I mentioned, most people will either have health insurance already, or they will be exempt because they don't file taxes. They don't earn enough to file taxes. Those people are not subject to the mandate, or because there will not be affordable coverage available to them, those people are exempt from the mandate. So if you have 260-some million people, and this is under age 65, pretty much everyone over age 65 has Medicare, that there's only going to be that 7% left who this could potentially impact. So it's really a small part of the population that we're talking about, but everybody keeps hearing it and reacting to it.
What other disconnects are there?
Well, there's a lot of real misperceptions about this. Actually, one of my favorite recent polling facts is that 1 in 7 people think the law has already been declared unconstitutional.
We can go home.
Yeah. Another 28% aren't sure. So that's a fairly large number that, yeah, wonders what we're all doing here. Then there's a lot of people that actually knowledge about the law has gone down since it passed 2 years ago. But there are some misconceptions that still persist. More than a third of people polled say it includes a government panel to make decisions about end-of-life care for people on Medicare. Those are the death panels. That is not in there. More than half think that it actually includes a government-run plan as an option. This was the big public option. For all those people who wanted it, not there.
Ari Shapiro, this sounds like, and I've heard this allegation of a big failure to communicate at the White House.
Yeah, the White House has heard that a lot, too. And in fact, they acknowledge that they did not do as good. You know, their line is, we were so busy creating the perfect product that we didn't bother to sell the product, which Republicans scoff at. The Republicans feel like they've been handed a huge gift. On the campaign trail over the last 6 months, traveling around with mostly Mitt Romney and the other candidates as well, I can tell you that consistently, one of the biggest applause lines in any stump speech is, I will repeal Obamacare. This 7% or 1 in 7 people who believe it's already been repealed are not at these Republican rallies because they know it has not been repealed, and they jump to their feet shouting and cheering when the candidate says, I will repeal Obamacare, which is interesting to me because when you talk to people about why they're passionate about a war, it's because their son or a neighbor or somebody is serving in a war. If you talk about why they're passionate about the unemployment rate, it's because they or someone they know is looking for work. When I ask them why they're passionate about repealing this healthcare law, the answer they give is it's a growth of government and an intrusion of government into our lives that is worrisome in the sense that we'll become a socialist European-style country. It's a very abstract concept that people feel very, very passionately about out there.
And in fact, it's interesting to me, I was listening to a Julie Rovner piece the other morning, and she had a piece of tape from Mitt Romney defending the Massachusetts mandate. And it was about as articulate a statement of why a mandate is necessary as I've heard. There is also the fact that the Obama White House, once they got this bill passed, they sort of dropped the ball. And what followed then was the Republican primary campaign over the last year or more, and they're not talking about their so-called signal achievement at all. The only people talking about this
bill are Republicans. And it's as if they woke up this week and realized, oh, gee, we better get with the program and see what kind of a message we can cobble together. It's a little late.
Although Republicans...
Well, there have been, what, 20 Republican debates, and they've talked about health care, I think, at every one. And in fact, that piece of Romney tape was from one of the debates.
Well, but Republicans are also divided among themselves a bit, or at least the White House hasn't gotten the message out enough as it wants, that some of these ideas in the health care law actually originated with Republicans.
Certainly the central idea, the idea for this individual mandate, it predates even Mitt Romney, I should add. It goes
back to the early 90s.
Yeah, even a little before that.
There
it goes back to the late 80s.
There were 27 Republican senators who agreed to support the idea of a mandate much like this one back in the early 90s. And Julie can tell you what they were opposing back then, why they came up with that debt. And it was some conservative groups like the Heritage Foundation, too.
They were imposing, at the time, it was the Clinton administration's proposal to have an employer mandate, to require employers to provide insurance. And the Republicans' alternative was the individual mandate. Now, there are those who will say now, well, it was, I think someone told me when I was doing this story, it was a parade that had no followers. So they abandoned it kind of quickly. But yes, there were many, many Republican lawmakers who thought that this was a good idea. And it was originally a conservative Republican idea to require individuals to have their own insurance rather than require employers to provide it for them.
Tom Goldstein, I wonder, in your experience with the Supreme Court, I mean, do you think there, you know, whatever decision the Supreme Court makes on this, is that going to influence public opinion in the end?
I think it will, to some extent. So, for example, Republicans talking to independents about how the statute is an incredible overreach. If John Roberts writes an opinion upholding the statute, then that becomes a harder story to tell. But with respect to either party's race, intuitively, I don't think anybody really is paying a huge amount of attention to reality, that this will be a rallying cry in either direction. If the statute is struck down, then liberal Democrats will really decry a conservative Supreme Court interfering in the democratic process. If it is upheld, it will demonstrate the wisdom of the Tea Party position, that the government has gotten completely out of control, that we need a new Republican president, that we need a new Senate and a new Congress, as Ari said, to change things. So, you know, I think that whatever the Supreme Court does is going to get twisted to meet a political agenda more than it will describe the reality of the situation.
Which is why, Ari, today's argument was interesting because it offered the court a chance to punt, to say, okay, if this is, we consider this a tax, we don't have to decide now and don't want to get involved in this very political year.
And they requested the opportunity to punt and then brought the opportunity before them and then pretty clearly signaled that they weren't going to take the opportunity.
The punt was a fake.
Right, exactly. And at the end, they very kindly thanked Robert Long, who they had invited to make the argument. You performed admirably, and I'm sorry, we tore you to shreds.
But, you know, I think it must have dawned on them, even since they ordered that argument. And in the name of completeness, after all, there was a circuit court, a federal appeals court, that said, we can't decide this case now. The law says we can't decide it. So in the name of completeness, it seems to me to be the correct thing to hear that issue. On the other hand, the more you think about it, the more you really have to think, how can we let the federal government and all the states turn themselves into a little tizzy for the next 2 years, getting ready for a law that we will then suddenly come in and possibly say is unconstitutional after they've spent billions of dollars setting it up. That doesn't make a lot of sense either.
But aren't the justices not supposed to consider that sort of thing?
I think that actually there are many members of the court who pride themselves on considering pragmatic solutions and on both sides, simply saying this is no longer a pragmatic thing to do.
As someone else put it, the country needs an answer.
Yes, as people have said, the country needs an answer.
Let's look ahead now to two more days of arguments coming up, and tomorrow it's the crux of the case, what makes it such a heated debate in the country, the individual mandate to buy health insurance. Nina, what will we hear? What will each side argue tomorrow?
Well, on one side, the challengers will say this is the first time that the federal government has ever told citizens that they have to buy a commercial product that they may not want. And that simply is more power than the federal government has. That is an invasion of personal liberty. And the other side will say, look, this is 1/6 of the economy, the healthcare industry. This isn't a question of telling people they have to consume something that they don't want. Everybody's going to consume health care at some point or another. You can't tell when you're going to get hit by a bus or get sick. And all that we can do is make sure that there is a system that pays for everybody, that there aren't freeloaders, and that's what people are who don't have insurance, and then they get sick, and everybody else has to pay for them, in essence, either through taxes or through increased premiums. I think the figure that's often cited, Congress found that every American family that has insurance pays $1,000 a year more to subsidize, in essence, the people who don't have insurance.
Something like $43 billion a year. Is that right, Julie? Mm-hmm.
Well, it was really interesting that Don Verrilli, the Obama administration solicitor general, came in and started his oral argument today almost talking about the argument tomorrow, talking about the incredible significance of it and why Congress had the power to do this.
This case presents issues of great moment, and the Anti-Injunction Act does not bar the court's consideration of those issues. That is so even though the Anti-Injunction Act is a jurisdictional limit that serves what this court described in Clintwood Elkhorn as an exceedingly strong interest in protecting the financial stability of the federal government, and even though the minimum coverage provision of the Affordable Care Act is an exercise of Congress's taxing power as well as its commerce power.
And so there he is setting up the two arguments that he will make tomorrow. One, what I described as the varsity argument, is that the Constitution in Article 1, the 8th section, says that Congress can regulate interstate commerce. As Nina was saying, well, fully a sixth of the economy touches on health care, and so how can that not be interstate commerce? And the second one is that Congress has an even broader power, if you can believe it, to pass taxes so that the federal government can have the money that it needs to operate. And he is setting the table for that massive constitutional fight. And that's the part of the case that people are going to be talking about for centuries.
All right. And moving on to Wednesday, we will have two issues before the court. In the morning, it will be what happens if the mandate is ruled unconstitutional. Then what?
So the question there is, one side, the challengers say, this is like a jigsaw puzzle. This is an incredible law, 2,700 pages. Each page has another little jigsaw puzzle piece. And if we take out a piece of the puzzle, the whole thing will crumble. Or to use another analogy that they use, if you cut the heart out of the bill, the individual mandate, you can't leave the body there twitching. The body's dead. there are many metaphors, but that is their view. The government says it is true that if you don't have a way...
Sorry, that is the view of...
That's the challengers. And the government agrees on one point. They say it is true that if there's no way to spread the risk and pay for it, we can't guarantee that everybody will be able to get affordable care, even though they may have had a pre-existing medical condition. But the rest of it, says the government, the rest of that bill basically should be able to stand. It shouldn't knock out the whole bill.
And yet there's another third view. So the court has appointed another private lawyer to take a position that neither of the parties do. And that other private lawyer says that you can actually come in and take the heart out with the tweezers. And you could just take out the individual mandate and everybody else will be fine.
Which is funny because you'd think that would be the government's argument. They would want as much as possible to stand.
That's true. They're trying to be realistic and they're also trying to raise the stakes some to make clear that because their argument is about interstate commerce and how this affects all of health care, they want to be able to show that this is an integrated jigsaw puzzle, that all the pieces have to fit together.
Also, the last thing that they would want, really, is a system that they would get stuck having to make work without enough money to make it work. And that's what would happen if they don't get a mandate.
And, Julie, that's an issue in the healthcare industry. Right?
That's right, and that would declare war. Getting rid of the mandate with nothing else, which is, of course, what the 11th Circuit did, would basically declare war in the insurance industry. The private insurance industry, which put out a lengthy statement today about all the various places that said, no, this can't work if you just get rid of the mandate without the pre-existing condition exclusion, too, which, of course, is the most popular thing in the law. But the two do have to go together. President Obama, when he was candidate Obama, did not support the mandate for just this reason. He was worried about the individual individual backlash, I mean, about the political backlash from it. But he was prevailed upon by some of his advisors to say that the two must go hand in hand, and the insurance industry.
Because you need those healthy people in the system
You need the healthy people to help spread the risk to for them to afford the sick people. And that was the deal that basically the administration cut with the insurance industry, which doesn't like the law for a whole variety of other reasons. They think, among other things, the penalty is too small. So the administration is arguing what many people consider sort of the responsible thing.
Okay. And Julie, sticking with you, in the afternoon then on Wednesday, there is the final fourth issue at debate here, the expansion of Medicaid that the health care law would enforce. Tell us what we're going to hear then.
This was a little bit of a surprise that the court actually took this. This is the argument of these 26 states that this is basically a coercion on the states, that requiring them to expand Medicaid to cover basically adults who are not parents, are not disabled, who are simply low income, because over the years Medicaid has usually been what's called a categorical program. You have to fit into a category. You have to be low income and a child, low income and a pregnant woman, low income and have a disability. And now what the law is saying is that you simply have to have a low income and you can qualify for Medicaid. Recognizing, however, that the states have a bit of a financial problem these days, the federal government's going to pay the vast majority of this bill. But the states still say, we really don't want any more mandate, you know, any more expansion of Medicaid, even though the federal government's going to pay most of the bill. We want no part of this. And if we don't take this part, then we could face the loss of all the rest of our Medicaid funding. And so they're arguing that this is coercive. And frankly, there's been very few cases on this issue. It's the spending clause of the Constitution. You know, what kind of conditions the federal government can put on money that it gives to the state. So it's going to be kind of an interesting
argument.
And some
say it could have implications beyond health care.
Of course. It could have implications on any other funding that the federal government gives to the states with conditions, which is education programs, highway money, basically welfare money, all of the various ways the federal government gives money to the states.
Okay. Thanks so much, NPR's Julie Rovner. We've also been joined by NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, our White House correspondent Ari Shapiro, and attorney Tom Goldstein of SCOTUS Blog. And we'll all be back, most of us, tomorrow as well for day two of the Supreme Court's hearings on health care. I'm Jennifer Ludden. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News.